Hi there.
Hi there. This is Go ahead.
This is Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow at the Center for American Progress.
And this is Matthew Gontanetti, and I'm a associate editor at the Weekly Standard and author of the K Street Gang. This is Blogging Heads TV. Matt, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine too. I think this is actually technically our first Blogging Heads together. If I recall, we recorded one last year sometime. But it was
and it went south.
It was destroyed or perhaps classified.
Yes.
And
we were also on C-SPAN once.
We were. That was way back. I think that was in the 04 campaign, actually.
So indeed.
Shows how we're maturing.
Exactly. Yes. Now we're on the internet.
Now we're on the internet.
It's going to be important in the future, I think.
It's a series of two.
Right. Exactly.
So I thought we'd talk about, well, first of all, I did want to get you. I noticed you did not, you had ambivalent feelings about Wolverine. Is that right to say? What were your,
Wolverine, I just, I had my cousin's bat mitzvah on Friday night, so I didn't go to see it until Saturday, and I'd seen my friend's Twitters against Wolverine, and so I was set up for like the worst movie ever, like Fantastic Four 2 or something like
right.
that, or Daredevil.
Rise of the
it's way better than
Surfer.
Those. Right.
Yeah.
And it's I thought, not that bad. That was how I would put it.
Here's what my, I haven't seen the movie yet, but basically when I look at the phenomenon of superhero movies, it seems to me that they are getting close to the point of jumping the shark. It seems like it made a lot of money, Wolverine did, but I'm not sure how much more creative energy is in the superhero franchise. And now I think we're going to enter this period of studios kind of looking for the next cash cow. I'm a little bit unclear as to what it is. My coworker, Jonathan Last, who's a kind of a film buff, he says it's
yes.
Star Trek, the new Star Trek, which he saw last night. I haven't gotten his take on it, but he was excited about it. He says that may be the return of the sci-fi film to kind of a big status. I don't know. What's your take?
Well, I think that would be nice. I mean, I like comic books, so I've been sort of excited at the comic book movie boom recently.
Right.
But, it's probably going too far. You start to get the sense that, well, like in this case, for example, instead of it really being that there was a story of Wolverine's origin that was really strong and that they wanted to bring to film, they just decided they wanted to bring to film the story of Wolverine's origin. It turned out there actually was no such story. And so Marvel threw up a comic book that was the Wolverine origin story, and it wasn't very good, but because they wanted to, at least preempt the movie makers to some extent, constrain them, then they put this movie together. It's not very good. The whole idea is sort of ill-conceived. And I think it wouldn't be a terrible thing for this ground to lie fallow. I think the fact that we went only maybe 5 years between Hulk movies and the reboot of that series, that to me was actually the moment when I think it became clear that we could use the studios to sort of give this a rest for a decade
right,
or so.
Right, right. Good point.
I like the Hulk.
From movies to reading,
so you saw
the movie on Saturday, and on Sunday, the New York Times Magazine published an essay by Russell Shorto, which I think is very interesting. It's called Going Dutch, and it's
yes.
Russell Shorto's a writer. He writes books. I think his most recent book is on New York, which is funny because it's about old New York and New Amsterdam, its original name, and of course, now he lives apparently in Amsterdam. He's writing about the experience of living in a social democracy like the Netherlands. Well, what I thought was interesting about this piece, he has good things to say about the society in which he now calls home as an American expatriate. He has some flaws, which I'll point out in a second. But
sure. It
seemed to me that it did a very good job of showing that the quality of life for what we can assume to be upper middle class American expatriates in Holland is okay, but he didn't seem to actually do much reporting to show how the poor in the Netherlands actually live. And I thought that was a big weakness of the piece. So,
yes, well, I mean, you know, it was a very sort of Times Magazine-y thing. I mean, I had a different experience of the Netherlands, which mm-hmm. was maybe 18 months ago. No, but it must have been 2 years ago now. I went over there to a conference that the Dutch Labor Party was sponsoring. They had a sort of affiliated think tank that was putting out a book about America. I contributed an essay to it, went over to the Netherlands. And so we were talking there about, you know, sort of social policy and political problems in the United States and in the Netherlands. In both countries, the left of center power party, rather, was out of power at the time. There was sort of concern about Islamic terrorism, things like that, some similar issues. And, you know, at that moment, there were sort of some stories in the news about political protests that had happened in a Muslim neighborhood in Rotterdam, I think, rather than Amsterdam, where I was. But anyway, I went to see what was a poor neighborhood in the Netherlands, and it was actually really striking how much better conditions were in, like, a quote-unquote bad neighborhood of Amsterdam versus a bad neighborhood of Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles or something like that. Now, they had some social problems there related to the integration of Muslim immigrants that we do not have. But in terms of the material living conditions there, I mean, you would see the library in the sort of it was like a public housing project, and then there was a public library there, and it was, you know, filled with school kids studying, you know, quietly, and there was a police officer helping an old lady with her groceries, and, you know, the kind of stuff that you sort of associate with America maybe from the 1950s, maybe it's not even really true, but sort of, you know, better times, more community spirit,
and
people could take advantage of a lot of services.
Yeah, what do you attribute that difference to, the Dutch welfare state?
Well, you know, I mean, I think there's a feedback mechanism. In part, the Dutch welfare state helps maintain these things. In part, the fact that there's a sense of order in a lot of these smaller northern European countries makes it more viable to have kind of generous welfare provision, I think.
So the culture matters.
The culture matters and the institutions matter, right? I mean, one thing. Well, so Schroeder goes into this in his piece in a, I think, a slightly superficial way, but that, you know, at first he had sort of sticker shock about the high prices in the Netherlands, and then he came to appreciate that, well, he was getting a lot of good services in return, and in part, you know, that's just because there's bigger government in the Netherlands, higher taxes, more services. But in part, it has to do with the efficacy with which the services are delivered. And that if you look at the sort of the best performing European countries, Netherlands, Denmark, Finland, Norway, places like that, they have really sort of high quality government. You know, the institutions work very well. The people are quite competent. Interactions with them are pleasant. If you look at more, say, Italy or Portugal, they have higher taxes than the United States and more services than the United States, but you get more of the quality of services that we associate with America, where many of the schools are not so good, where a lot of people's interactions with the Department of Motor Vehicles, you know, leave a sour taste in their mouth. So, you know, I mean, I do think the most important thing as a liberal is to not be afraid to spend money, but that you have to actually make the money worthwhile. The services need to really be good and not just be expensive.
I think that's an interesting point. What struck me about the piece were a few things. One, I think he left out the true cost of the Dutch welfare state. He does mention the 52% tax rate on income. Mm-hmm. I don't know the Dutch tax system. I don't know whether it's progressive like ours, so I don't know whether that's a flat rate, that 52%, or whether he's in a higher bracket or what bracket he is in the Netherlands. But he says that's 52% of his income, but he never mentions the VAT, which I believe is 19% on all products. And he also mentions the, and there are additional taxes as well. He mentions early on in the piece how quaint it is that he rides his bicycle everywhere. Well, there's a reason for that, and the reason for that is there's a 40% car tax, I'm told, per vehicle, as well as fuel taxes, which rise, you know, raise the price of fuel to about, I think, $7 is the equivalent a gallon. So, there is a cost to all of this. It's hard for people in Washington sometimes to understand the concept that there's no such thing as a free lunch, because there are so many free lunches here. But the money has to come from somewhere. And the Dutch, it seems, I don't know their debt-to-GDP ratio or how big their deficit is, but they tax a lot. And what that does, it seems...
Yes, very high taxes.
Yeah, they're very high taxes. And you talk about the services they have, but it seems it's very political. From my perspective, rather than the Dutch or the American government giving me an allotment for my vacation, which is what he has in the piece, he says it just appears in his ATM, they tax at the front end, and then they politically determine how much you're going to spend on vacation. I would say, well, why don't you keep the taxes low, and then I can determine how much I spend on my vacation. I guess that's just the liberal-conservative difference, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, I actually think that the vacation thing is a little bit idiosyncratic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the main difference is that there are certain services provided there which are difficult to provide on a sort of an individual basis, right? I mean, it's things like people use their cars substantially less there, in part because the taxes are much higher, in part because there's much better trams, there's much better sidewalks, there's much better bicycle facilities. They have programs.
It's also extremely small, right?
It's densely populated. It's
right.
It's like New Jersey. But
yeah, it's a population of 16 million, so twice the population in New York and a country the size of New Jersey, yeah.
Right, exactly. They do things like they have sort of community child health centers, you know, little sort of places in the neighborhoods where you can come in and, you know, your kid gets treated if he's sick or if you just need some kind of, you know, advice about, you know, what you do coping with these problems. And, I mean, of course, it has a redistributive impact, you know. A lot of these are services that upper middle class Americans, you know, can purchase on their own, but that poorer Americans can't afford to purchase. In the Netherlands, by taxing a lot and then putting it back through the government ringer, you get a much flatter sort of distribution of consumption goods than you have in the United States. And I mean, of course, that is probably the main difference between left and right, is that, you know, on the right there's a desire to privatize more of this stuff. On the left there's a desire to socialize more of it. But that's not just about making things collective. It's about making things more equally shared across. The United States is a very high inequality society. The Netherlands is much lower. But you know, it is true that you have less. Particularly as a prosperous person, there's more sort of constraints on what you can do there because the taxes are.
Do you think that there? There's a trade-off. America has more inequality, but the promise of reward if you get into the higher echelons, middle class, upper middle class, or you know, affluence, is much greater. Than in the Dutch system, you would say. And wouldn't you say that that's maybe one of the reasons why people continue to immigrate to America, this promise of greater reward, greater risk, there's no doubt about it, but also potential greater rewards?
Well, I don't really. I think people immigrate to the United States from Mexico because the United States is clearly a...
Yeah, but that's not... Mexico is not the only place where people are immigrating.
Oh, no, to be sure. I mean, but of course, there are lots of immigrants in the Netherlands as well. They come from Indonesia, they come from Suriname, they come from some places in North Africa. The main difference in the number of immigrants that actually get to any given developed country is how many immigrants they choose to let in. I think we in the Netherlands let in a similar number of people. Canada lets in a higher percentage. Finland lets in a lower percentage. I mean, I'll say this. There was a Brookings study that came out, I think, in 2007, and it looked at the question of intergenerational income mobility in different countries. And it showed that Americans place a much higher value on social mobility and believe that our society affords a great deal of social mobility. And it's one of the main things Americans like about America is that kind of openness and mobility. But they found that the United States actually has less social mobility than most European countries, more than the UK, but less than Denmark, less than Finland, less than Germany, less than France. So it's a very important part of American psychology, you know, the idea that sort of anyone can make it big here, and that the rewards for making it big will be very large. But it's actually quite difficult to move up from the lower
classes. Why do you think it's difficult?
I think it's difficult because primarily because of disadvantages in human capital accumulation, that poor children start school already behind middle class and richer kids, and then they are served very poorly by the school system and to some extent by the healthcare system. And I think, you know, that pretty much explains it.
It's interesting to me because the short of piece was very revealing. I sense a great tendency on the left, the American left, these days, to really push for America to move toward a European-style social democracy. We have a welfare state in the United States. We'd agree on that. Basically, it covers old people. It covers retirees. That's where our main welfare state is. There's also some for young people, that is, dependents. And then, of course, yes. There is still cash welfare payments to single mothers and stuff, though that was reformed in 1996. We have a welfare state in the United States. The one missing component of it is a universal health insurance program, a national health insurance program.
Yes.
That's one of the highlights in Shorto's piece. It said, well, everyone has in the Netherlands healthcare, universal healthcare. What was interesting to me, though, is he mentions it only briefly in the piece, but in fact the Dutch recently reformed their system to increase competition, to increase choice, and to inject more free market mechanisms into this universal program. Which would seem to me to show that there are limits to what a national healthcare system can do without, you know, some sort of competition and choice. Wouldn't you agree?
There's a huge variety in what national healthcare systems look like. I mean, this is one of the reasons the congressional debate on this is very complicated, right? I mean, if there were one single thing that was, you know, a universal healthcare system, then we could have a debate about whether or not, you know, that thing was a good idea. But if you look, I mean, the healthcare system in Switzerland is very different from the system in France, is very different from the system in Canada. So there's a sort of a whole range of things. The United States, obviously coming at this from a much more market-oriented status quo, I think is likely to move to something along the lines of the Swiss system or the new Dutch system. Whereas the Dutch had previously, I think, had a system that was more like what's in place in Germany. And clearly there's a desire to try to maintain choice and competition among healthcare providers, right, among sort of doctors and hospitals. That's something that people like a lot and that there's some kind of results for. And that has a... It's related to the question of health insurance, but it's not totally the same. So that, for example, on Medicare, we have a completely government-run insurance system, but the actual delivery of healthcare services is entirely in private hands. So you can have the two. I don't actually think it works all that well, but old people and voters are very enthusiastic about Medicare, so, you know, that's sort of what you get.
Just one more question I have on this piece. It seems okay, but you would agree, though, that you know, the left right now they want to move America more toward a system like the Netherlands or more like Denmark, say, or Finland. You've been to Finland. You enjoy Finland
yes.
very much. So basically, we want to push us in the direction of a Northern European social democracy. Is that fair?
Certainly, I do.
Yes. Yeah, right. And I think you're representative of the left, especially kind of younger folks on the left. My question, whenever I confront this, there are, to me, there are reasons that America hasn't already been to that place, why we don't have a fully developed social democracy.
And many reasons.
I think the left would say the primary reason is corporate power. That's what's been stopping us and entrenched special interests. And, you know, we have the Senate and stuff, and it's hard to, it's much harder to reform. I'm not so sure about that, though. And what came across to me in this piece was some conversations that Shorto, an American who is enjoying his life over there, and American expatriates tend to enjoy their life simply because they have the means to move to another country to begin with. There's no reason to think that they wouldn't have a better quality of life if they moved anywhere else, or worse. He's talking with the Dutch, and they say, well, listen, you know, the pillars of Dutch society are consensus and security.
Right.
And I look at American society, and you know, consensus and collectivity, you do not describe this America. They don't at all. I would say rather we're a nation of disputatious, argumentative individuals, and also extremely diverse. The Dutch, if you look at the ethnic composition of the Netherlands, about 80% of this population of 16 million, this very small population, are ethnic Dutch, and the rest are 20% immigrants. You know, I'm not sure where most of the Dutch immigrants come from, probably Muslim-speaking countries in Africa,
It's Suriname and Indonesia.
Oh, in Indonesia, right. Well, of course, they have a historical legacy there, right.
Right, exactly.
So it's a much more homogenous country than ours.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And a much more consensus-based culture than ours. Wouldn't that be almost a... Let me phrase it this way. Do you sense that our culture is changing more in line with what you would find in the northern European social democracies?
No, I mean, I think the United States, you know, is a very different place. It's why we have very different policies. You know, the question that's difficult, right? I mean, there's definitely an association between relatively small, relatively homogenous populations and a certain kind of politics and policy environment. The reason American policy isn't like Finnish or Dutch or Norwegian policy is that the United States isn't like Finland or the Netherlands or Denmark or any of those other places.
Right.
There's a question of whether that's intrinsic, right? I mean, is it that the kind of school system that they have in Finland or the kind of worker training programs that they have in Denmark actually couldn't be made to work in a large, more diverse society, which I don't really think? Or is it just that it's much more politically difficult to, you know, persuade people that it would be a good idea, which I think certainly is the case. I mean, America, we have different political institutions, we have different traditions, we have different kinds of people who have different kinds of interest. So I don't, you know, I don't think, I think it's a lot of conservatives, I mean, Mitch McConnell has led the way on this, some other conservatives, in saying that, you know, Barack Obama is going to transform America into a European-style welfare state. And frankly, you know, I would do that if I could, and maybe Barack Obama would, but I don't think he will. I mean, it's not
and the
really
primary
a
reason
feasible just, short-term goal.
Right, but the primary reason you would do that is because you would have more equality, right? You want to do that because the median... The 50th percentile person in Iglesias land would be better off than the 50th percentile person in the United States of America, right?
That yes, I believe.
They'd have more government services and such. We'd be leveled. The population would be leveled, right?
Well, and I also think, I mean, not just leveling, but I think that ultimately it would allow for better sort of long-term growth prospects.
So you're dissatisfied with the quality of life, the standard of living of the person in the 50th percentile in the United States today?
Well, I mean, to be clear, I mean, I think everyone needs to understand that anyone who is alive today in the United States of America or in the Netherlands is far better off than the vast majority of people in the world presently or through historical circumstances. I mean, politics largely consists of disagreeing about, you know, domestic economic arrangements. So, you know, we spend a lot of time on the kinds of differences between these countries. But, you know, in the scheme of things, the median American is extremely well off, and you know, minorly improving or worsening their living standards is not, you know, I think in God's eyes, it's sort of not that big a deal what kind of healthcare system we have in that sense, right? I mean, the biggest problems in the world are in China, they're in Africa, they're in India, things like that.
Right.
But I mean, I do think we could do better in the United States and ought to try.
Right. And but the, again, the money has to come from somewhere. I would say this though, the political system is different than here than it is in those Northern European countries. And
but the sense of community is different.
The
right?
sense of I mean, community is different. The space is different. We are this huge, huge country of more than 300 million people. The ethnic composition is different. We have about 2/3 are what we do call white Americans, descendants of European mm-hmm. immigrants to the United States. A third then are everyone else. So there is much more ethnic diversity. There's regional diversity. There's you know, political diversity. Though actually not as much, you would say, as you might find in some of the other parliamentary democracies across the world. And there cultural diversity, certainly, because of this overall arching culture of what I would say disputatious, you know, individualism. People like to have their identities, and they like to argue about it, and they don't like people who don't share their identities, whatever they construct them to be. Coming from my right of center perspective, I'd say, well, okay, well, let's look at this country that we have, this amazing, powerful, rich, beyond the wildest dreams of average country, and then let's see how we can keep those qualities while also maybe marginally improving the condition of the person in the 50th percentile. Seems to me the left either doesn't think that those characteristics are all that important that I've laid out, the uniqueness of America, or you know, at the end of the day, they don't matter because we need to make sure that the income distribution is as, you know, reasonably flat as it can be.
You know, I really don't think that's right. I mean, you know, the whole thing with Europe, to be honest, I mean, this is an argument that conservatives really started when Americans were just trying to talk about, you know, ways to change our own policies. People started saying, oh, it's going to be terrible. It's going to be like Europe. So, you know, people come back.
No, that's not true. I've read John Cohn in the New Republic saying Denmark is the way to go. Robert Kuttner has said the same thing. On your blog,
well, that's
you
true.
Said,
there is, there
you,
is this.
On your blog, you said Finland, after your trip there, you said Finland was, God, what, you know, why can't we be more like Finland? It's not the totally
right.
No, right.
And look, I mean, I think there's lots of, but I don't think anyone, I mean, you read John Cohn's article about Denmark, you read my article about Finland. You know, I mean, everyone is aware that you cannot transform the United States into a small Scandinavian country, right? I mean, that doesn't really mean anything as a proposition. And you know,
so what's
obviously
the point of these articles? It's to show how they do policy there, and
well, it's to show how they do policy there. I mean, it's to show that, you know, there are existing models of high tax, high service, high growth economies, which is an important, you know, sort of point to make. You know, I mean, when you look into really concrete sort of issues, right, in particular, just the greater geographical diversity of the United States makes a huge difference. I mean, the United States has multiple large metropolitan areas, which is not, you know, the case in small countries, which usually have one big city. That city has suburbs, then people live in sort of miscellaneous small towns. So you can do different kinds of planning. But, you know, I mean, when you talk about things, right, like, does it show that investing more money in retraining displaced workers can help build political support for free trade? It can help people find jobs. You know, Denmark is a pretty good example. If there were other giant rich countries, I think
not,
we could learn more from them, but there aren't.
Is there,
right?
Really, I mean, a political debate in America about retraining displaced workers? I mean, didn't John McCain run on exactly... I mean, I don't think there was any difference between the two major candidates in the last election.
No. I mean, there wasn't. I mean, that's exactly the point. I mean,
right.
neither candidate was proposing anything nearly as ambitious.
You'd agree that the debate that you would like to have, right, is how high do taxes need to go to provide these services that you would like to provide, right? That's the debate.
Well, I mean, I think it's a... you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Democratic Party politicians don't want to say, well, we should have much higher taxes. You know, I think, in fact, we probably should.
Right.
But that's, I mean, anyway, all I was saying is that there are only so many countries in the world, besides the United States and Japan, there aren't any other, like, big, rich countries. So, you know, you have to, if you want to try to draw any conclusions from foreign countries, you wind up drawing conclusions based on much smaller countries, and that's not, I mean, that's not really anybody's fault. As best I can tell, absolutely no one thinks the United States should be more like Japan.
right. Well, not especially with their recent economic performance, and even there, the parallel is even worse because God, what's the ethnic composition of Japan? I mean, it must be 90%, 95%.
Very
yeah.
homogenous.
Yeah, it's extremely
very
homogenous.
I think actually Steve Saylor likes to talk of Japan.
Besides, I think we'll move on to another topic, but I think this is the core, and I think that here's what we can do is transition. But when Arlen Specter left the GOP last week, he didn't give as his reason his pro-choice stance. He's been pro-choice for decades. That's not why he left the party. A lot of the social conservatives in the party get a lot of heat. Oh, you're rejecting heretics and whatnot. But no, that's not why he left.
Sure.
Why he left was his vote on the stimulus, which I think is going to turn out to be a dividing line in American politics. In a way, even that the Iraq vote wasn't, because the Iraq vote was so bipartisan. I mean, majorities in both parties supported it, at least in the Senate, not in the House.
Right.
Most House Democrats were against the Iraq War. In any case, the stimulus, you have a real dividing line about the size of government. And that's why Arlen Specter was ejected, or rather felt he had to leave the party. He wasn't ejected like Joe Lieberman was in the 2006 Democratic
but
primary.
But he would have been. Right, I mean, Specter was on the
road. Yeah, but he never does that. And it looked right, yeah, at the end of the day. But we never had the contest, so. Basically, what I want to know from you, my question for you is, the big tent, the Republican big tent has been packed up, it's been shipped, who knows, it's someplace in Tennessee or somewhere, it's in cold storage.
Sure.
Waiting. The tent is over, we have partisan ID for Republicans at decades low support, we have 60 Democratic senators when Al Franken is being seated for the first time since the Carter presidency. Basically, the GOP is at its, as its nadir. Basically, it's returned to where it was post-Watergate, post-74 election, and post-76 election. And as my question for you is, what are you guys at the Center for American Progress Action Fund doing to make this permanent? What do you think would make this type of thing as permanent as possible, stipulating that there are no permanent majorities?
Sure. Well, I think people sometimes deride the nonpartisan credentials of someplace like the center. But speaking for myself, I mean, I fully expect the Republicans to be back and to be back pretty soon. I mean, maybe they'll lose ground in the next two elections and they'll be back in 2014.
Why do you think they're going to be back?
Because, I mean, that's just how American politics works. You know, there's an ebb and a flow to it. The geography of the Senate races 2 years from now is bad for them. And if the economy is recovering, Barack Obama will be reelected. So that's, you know, relatively pessimistic on the Republicans. But then the geography of the Senate races will be better, you know, in the midterms after that.
Right.
The economy's sure to go down again. And so, you know, I don't personally spend too much time worrying about how to get Republicans to lose elections or to get voters not to vote for them. The question is you know, what kind of Republican Party comes back, right? Is it a more moderate party, or is it the kind of party that's being built right now, which is, you know, very conservative sort of across the board on everything? And because of the way American politics and American political institutions work, it's extremely hard to sort of, you know, do things with one party being just really fundamentally opposed to any kind of constructive action on climate, to any kind of, you know, provision of public services, things like that. So, you know, I don't totally know what can happen, because I'm pretty sure Republicans will be back pretty soon, one way or the other. You know, I hope people do things like, you know, read Ross Douthat's column today and think of ways to sort of, you know, not bring back, like, Arlen Specter style, you know, I'll cut a deal with whomever, but, you know, think of some real ideas about how to tackle problems. I think there's, you know, a lot of... I don't think that, like, free market economics is bunk and there's, like, nothing to be said for it.
That's pretty sure.
But I don't think... I don't think that Mike Pence and Eric Cantor are really offering an important contribution to the American policy.
So you would say that you spend less time worrying about Republican power and more time worrying about conservative power. That's what you would say.
Well, you know, I don't think even conservative or not conservative. Because,
so what do you,
you
spend
know,
time worrying about?
What? Conservative is defined in a certain... I think a big problem in the United States is the just sort of obsession with the sort of Grover Norquist style, you know, no tax can ever go up under any circumstances for any reason kind of thing. I think America could become a much better place if we could move beyond that idea.
And why do you think, I mean, the reason that he's against all taxes is because he doesn't want to grow government, right?
I mean, in part that's why it is, but in part it's because he's kind of I think an idiot. I mean, you know, I remember, for example, there was a debate, this was maybe a month ago on the corner, and Jerry Taylor was trying to say that things like the tax deduction for homeownership, right, that those kind of subsidies that are done as tax cuts, right, that really constitutes government intervention in the economy.
Right.
And that it would make sense to get rid of some of those kind of deductions. And he was getting a lot of heat from other people who were saying, well, since when is someone from the Cato Institute for tax hikes? You know, and I just think it's that's like a way too simplistic way of looking at it, right? The 1986 tax reform that, you know, was, I think, one of the major accomplishments of the Reagan administration, that Senator Bob Packwood, as a Republican, was a major actor for, I think that... You know, that was a really good piece of legislation. It was something that was done in a bipartisan way. But it's something that I think the current rules of conservatism would rule off the table because it was on net, you know, revenue neutral, but it did make some taxes higher.
Right.
And, you know, you can't talk about that kind of thing in the Republican Party.
Let me make 2 points. One, Grover Norquist is not an idiot. And I say that as someone who... criticized him in the past.
No, you know, you're right. I shouldn't have said that. I've talked to him, and he's not.
In fact, he's extremely smart, and he's worth reading, and he does, I think his beliefs are genuinely held. He thinks the power to tax is the power to destroy. He doesn't like big government. He knows that the more revenue, as you know, the more revenue the government gets, the more services it can provide, and he doesn't want the government to provide services. That's an ideological difference. Now, that said, that stipulated, there is knee-jerk Republican reaction to, or conservative reaction, I should say, to revenue increases. I'll give you an example. When Bush outlined his market health care plan in the, I believe it was the 07 State of the Union address, this is the plan later adopted, modified slightly by John McCain, a lot of Republicans, House Republicans, didn't know what to do. They didn't know whether to support the president's plan because they thought since it would begin to tax benefits, health care benefits, while also providing individuals a tax credit, I believe, or deduction, either way, to purchase the insurance on the open market, they thought that would be a net tax increase. They were opposed to tax increases, whatever. I was told that actually Norquist would inform the House GOP members, that don't worry about it. You can support it because you can always shave off, you know, you can shave off the, you know, the phone tax or whatever in order to get to revenue net neutral point. But you're right. There is kind of this ad hoc opposition, which I think it is troubling for the GOP in this sense, which is that we are accumulating debt at the point that it's just unsustainable for a great power. There's going to be a trade-off down the line, which is, do you want to continue to be a great power or not? And if you do, you can't sustain this level of spending with this level of deficit spending. Two ways to handle that. One way is to increase revenue, and there I think the discussion ought to be about And this is what I think maybe Ross hints at in his column. He doesn't go this far, but it is an excellent column today. How do you do that? Do you do that in ways that won't punish the economy? Do you do that by taxing things we should have less of, say like carbon, and maybe lowering taxes on things that we should have more of, like jobs, like work? Or do you do that by across-the-board income tax hikes? Mm-hmm. And then the second part of it is, at some point, I think GOP people, they're starting it with earmarks, which is stupid, because earmarks are such a small part of the federal budget. But you have to constrain overall government spending in order to get these imbalances in order. And I do think that, again, going back to the stimulus as a real dividing line in American politics, it's going to be spending where you're going to have most of the debates in American politics in the age of Obama. And I don't know how that will... I don't know how that will play out. How do you think?
I don't know. I mean, the dilemma of sort of spending politics is that the controversy around spending seems almost inversely proportional to the amount of money that's actually spent on sort of a given program, right? I mean, as you were saying, earmarks have come under enormous attack to the point where, you know, Barack Obama had a lot of sort of anti-earmark talk in his campaign. Senator Claire McCaskill is a Democrat. She's very passionate about clamping down on earmarks. But as you say, there's almost no money, you know, involved in earmarks. By contrast, Medicare is really expensive. I mean, a ton of money is spent on Medicare. And there's a lot of evidence that that money is not spent very effectively. And, you know, Peter Orszag has a lot of slides about this. It's something that liberal sort of wonks are very well aware of. And yet there's no political interest whatsoever, from Republicans or from Democrats.
Well, that's because in the past, 1995, when the GOP
yes.
tried to constrain Medicare costs, the government was shut down and the Democrats were able to tar the GOP quite effectively as opposing increases and benefits for seniors.
There were other issues in that specific debate, but that was the point, right? Is that the kind of spending that it's politically easiest to attack is the kind of spending that's like small dollar and trivial, whereas the big spending, right, which is Medicare, Social Security, and the Defense Department, right, that's where nobody, you know, wants to say there for cuts.
Right.
So I think it's difficult to have. It's hard for me to know what a political debate oriented around spending that's going to leave, you know, all the biggest spending items off the table is going to look like.
Well, I'm not sure.
I think it may look pretty silly.
Yeah, no, it would look silly, but I'm not sure the big items are going to be left off the table. I recently wrote a piece for the Weekly Standard about this SAFE Commission Act. Frank Wolf is behind it, the Virginia GOP congressman. He's got Jim Cooper, the leader of the Blue Dogs, the Democrat from Tennessee, behind it. Again, it's government by commission, which has always shown mixed results in Washington, but it does have a mechanism in order to address Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and taxes. And also say, the commission would report out saying, okay, we have structural deficits. They are
right.
unsustainable, especially with the levels of additional spending that Obama is proposing. So that's one method. We could see, I think, the big ticket items.
That would be an interesting commission.
It would be, and I think you could see the big ticket items on the table. The White House is adamantly opposed to such a commission. I will say this. If only Nixon could go to China, maybe only Barack Obama can reform Medicare. And Orszag, you're absolutely right. The Ryan Lissa piece profile of Orszag was really interesting. It went into his methods cost control in Medicare. The comparative effectiveness research is part of that. The health information technology spending is part of that. Down the line, it's going to, I think Obama in his interview with David Leonhardt that was published in the NYT magazine over the weekend, you know, giving this heartbreaking story of his grandmother and having to have the hip replacement and such.
Right, with the hip, yes.
You have the sense that they're going to move in the direction where kind of like a progressive indexing thing where wealthier recipients of Medicare are going to have to pay more in order to get some of these, you know, actuarially costly items, replacing the hip of a 90-year-old who probably doesn't have much longer left anyway. That will be an interesting debate. I will say, if you can do it, If he does propose it, Republicans in the interest of the country would be well served working with him in order to constrain these entitlements, because it's the only way. The only way they're going to get reformed is by Democrats taking the lead. And so this would be a good opportunity for the GOP, as constructive critics would be, say, yes, we want to work with you. The big missed opportunity in Bill Clinton's second term, we have plenty of indications that Bill Clinton mm-hmm. wanted to reform Social Security in his last 2 years. Probably not in a way you would have liked. Nonetheless, he did want to reform it.
Sure.
He couldn't because of the partisan warfare over the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Again, if we take the Democratic president to reform entitlements, do you think that's right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably correct. And, you know, I mean, and I think there's, you know, there's some indications of interest in that. I mean, I saw a story quoted. I think it's Karen Tomalty's new piece in Time, and it's talking about Obama meeting with some Republicans about health care. And I think it's Obama is saying, well, you know, maybe we should look at curbing malpractice lawsuits, you know, something conservatives talk about. And he said, well, you know, what are you guys, what would you guys, you know, give me on health care, you know, if we did that? And they basically, you know, they had nothing because they were kind of, you know, house guys and a little confused. And that was over, like, pretty small bore stuff, right? It would take, I think, bigger thinkers, bigger men than we may have in the Congress on both sides, not just men, women too, of course, to sort of, you know, to say to him, President Obama, you know, you're talking about malpractice, but, like, let's talk about serious cost controls in Medicare. You know, and then Obama says, whoa, you know, like, that's big. I need something really big in return. And then they come up with something, right? I mean, that kind of big deal making. It's hard to imagine, and that's what gets people sort
You're
of
saying swapping
out.
Support for something like the public option for cost controls in Medicare.
Well, something like a healthcare system that covers everyone the way Medicare doesn't, but that is not so so hugely expensive on a per-person basis the way Medicare is, right? I mean, because right now we have this weird system where, like, if you're under 65, the government does, like, nothing useful for you in terms of health care. But if you're over 65, you get a system that's so generous that people get a lot of, you know, services that appear to be unnecessary, where even very wealthy people pay very small shares out of pocket. And it doesn't – I mean, there's historical reasons why we developed that way, but that's not it's not fiscally sustainable, and it also doesn't particularly serve the social justice objectives that you know, liberals have.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting, and I'm just trying to think of some chip that Republicans could potentially swap. I mean, the public option, for various reasons about the size of government, I think is a non-starter for Republicans. They're going to oppose it. It'd be wise, while this will all be in reconciliation anyway, so they, you know, they'll be right to oppose it. Doing S-CHIP, I'll give you an example. I have no idea why Republicans oppose S-CHIP. Being against health care for kids, it's got to be the stupidest.
Yeah, well, that's a tough one.
It's got to be the stupidest thing. You know, it's just, if I were a Republican leader, you say, okay, President Obama, I'll get you. I mean, they don't need the votes anyway. So Republicans, in some ways, are marginal to this entire debate. But
right. You
would say, okay, I'm going to support you. Basically, what Republicans want is the government will take care of you after you retire, and they'll take care of you before you become an able-bodied adult. But in between those years, we have a free market plan that we want to implement where you get a tax credit or deduction, and we were going to increase competition, so you'll buying healthcare insurance, health insurance will be mm-hmm. a lot like buying auto insurance and such. That's what we want in between those years. But we're welcome to work with you on the years below 18 and the years above 65. Or, since I personally think we need to raise the retirement age to somewhere closer to 70, wherever that retirement age is placed. That, to me, would be sensible compromise politics. Would you agree?
You know, I don't think I would frame the compromise in exactly that way. But I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, this is, right, I mean, if you're talking about a big compromise, right, there's two things. And one is sort of, what is the sort of objective correlation of political power at the moment?
Well,
right?
At the moment, so, it's all Democrats. So, like I say,
well, but
really
so,
matter.
I mean, so now, if there were to be a compromise, it would be a compromise that was tilted in the direction of what Democrats want.
Sure.
I think more likely Republicans would need to recover some more political power,
right,
to make it, you know, worth people's while to,
right,
to compromise.
Well, we're in continental land here, where, you know, big.
Right. I mean, what you were suggesting would be a you know, I mean, a huge giveaway for Democrats who don't really need to make it,
right,
in the short term.
Right.
But you know, it's the operations of the American Congress, to me at least, just do not inspire a huge amount of confidence in, you know, in anything.
We can,
right?
Agree.
I mean,
Right.
I mean, so, you know, whatever you thought about Obama's stimulus proposal, I don't think anyone thought, oh, when the congressional committees get through changing this, it's going to be a lot better,
right?
Right.
Right. I agree with that.
You know, and that's the way it kind of goes with everything, right? I mean, unfortunately, it wasn't like George W. Bush's worst ideas, from my point of view, even, were the ones that got stopped in Congress, right? I mean, there was a tendency for sort of the bigger and, to some extent, more meritorious things that would come out of the administration to get killed there, because it steps on someone's toes. So, you know, I mean, this is why you have congressmen themselves always thinking about, well, you know, can we appoint a commission, something like that, get some way, you know, somehow take this out of our hands. But, you know, I just don't know. I mean, how much can you really get done through that mechanism before the system breaks down versus, you know, does Congress need to find some way to, you know, reform its own procedures?
Well, I think we can agree that we will. We started this discussion by saying that we're getting older, and I think we'll be much older still. We'll be doing blogging heads. Who knows? By the time Congress actually starts reforming itself,
sure,
we'll be doing these dialogues on holograms. But
we'll be getting ready for our Medicare.
Actually, you're right. We'll have much more invested in the debate then, because we'll be about to go on it. But
yeah, it's gonna be great.
Why don't we leave it at that, Matt Iglesias?
Okay.
It's been very interesting to me to get your thoughts on a lot of these topics. I've enjoyed this discussion.
Well, thank you. I think we had a good discussion.
Okay. Thanks,
and,
Matt.
And, you know, maybe we'll serve on a commission someday.
One day. We can only hope. Bye-bye.
Exactly. Bye.